Okay, so before we start on the Haggadah, I wanted to share this one thought. I actually shared it last night in a different shiur of mine, but it's something which is very empowering to many of us who do spend a lot of time preparing and cleaning for Pesach. There is a quote from the great Rav Leib Yitzchak Berditchev, great Hasidic Rebbe, and he would note that every single time you scrub, or you clean, or you vacuum, or you dust for Pesach, he says you're creating on your behalf a malach, an angel, in Shemayim to come and plead on your behalf. So the same way that in mitzvos in general, as we do mitzvos, the rabbis teach us that we're creating angels to come and advocate for us. So cleaning for Pesach is no less. So as you sit there and you scrub and you vacuum and you clean and you wipe and everything else you do to get for Pesach, realize you're not just going through labor, you're actually creating angels on your behalf in Shemayim. And he actually said that one time it was after he blew the shofar Rosh Hashanah. And if you notice in the Machzor in Rosh Hashanah, after he blew the shofar, there's a little paragraph, a little tefillah we say. And the tefillah says essentially that all the judgment in heaven that's against us should be flipped into rachmanis, into compassion. So he would say, Hashem, I just blew shofar. And that's not such a hard thing to do. I mean, you have to know the skill, but I blew shofar, just little old me blowing shofar. And I was just succeeded in flipping around the din in Shemayim, the prosecution in Shemayim, to mercy. So he says that when people clean for Pesach, they put in so much more effort than blowing shofar. So certainly that should bring about compassion from Shemayim. So it gives a little different take on our clean for Pesach to show that no, when we clean for Pesach, it's not just labor, it's not just hard work, but it's actually part of a mitzvah, a very special mitzvah. And up in Shemayim, it is creating angels advocating on our behalf in every single scrub we do. So we should look at our scrubs differently. So that's just an introduction to Pesach. So I wanted to go through the Haggadah a bit. Actually, I wanted to bring my Haggadah. I forgot to. I have a stack of Haggadahs we should bring. I forgot to bring them this year, but we'll bring it next week. I'm not so sure I'm going to try to bring them next week. So everyone, most of us are familiar with the Haggadah. It's, you know, every year we do it, so hopefully we're familiar with the text and what's happening. I'll try to fill us in. Okay. If we knew where they were, we would use them, but who knows? But the I've been going through this year, this Haggadah I bought when I was in Israel. It's called Umasoka Or. This is actually, his name is Rabbi Shlomo Levenstein. He's become a very big speaker in Israel for the past few years. I mean, he now has, there's dozens of books out of his different speeches and stories that he says. And it's a Haggadah that's filled with just different points, interesting stories. So I've been going through this a little this year. Every year I try to take a Haggadah and sort of go through it to get some new ideas.
Rabbi, the author again?
Rabbi Shlomo Levenstein. Levenstein. So in Israel, he's become a very big speaker, a very inspirational speaker, and his svarim are getting around. So this is Haggadah. So I wanted to take some different snippets of his Haggadah to share with you and to go through different pieces of the Haggadah. So to begin, I'm not going to discuss too much of we have the Seder plate and the different items on the Seder plate. So I'm not going to get too much into that, but I want to share one thought that he quotes about the Seder plate. Now we have on the Seder plate an obligation to put there two cooked foods. The custom is to have the egg and then the bone, the roasted bone. That's our custom. And the simple reason for it is that they're both supposed to be remembrances of the karbanos that we can't bring anymore. It used to be we'd bring the Karban Pesach. We also bring what's called, we bring the Chagiga. That's the Chagiga is the karban brought for Yontif. And nowadays, at the Beis HaMikdash, we can't bring either. So we have on the Seder plate two things to remind us of those karbanos. That's why they're there. But the custom is, so the halacha says you can put any two cooked things you want. But the minug, the custom has become to put the bone and the egg. So he discusses here a different symbolism behind why I put the egg there. And there's a lot of discussion as to why the egg has become the custom, but he says an interesting point. He says that there is a special symbolism of an egg. Because when the Jews were in Egypt, so we had to work very, very hard. And the harder we worked, we still remained close to Hashem. We know that the Jews, the more they were pressured, they would call out to Hashem in their prayers and their tefillah to be saved. And it says that it's quoted in many different Sifri Hasidus, when Hasidic works. Then egg is different than other foods. Most foods, when you cook them, they get softer. We know an egg is a liquid, and when we cook it, it gets hardened. So that's why it's so important in many recipes, because it hardens the recipe. So it's really a unique food in that sense. So Jews are like that. It says the Jews were known as Am Keshe Oref. We're stubborn, stiff-necked people, the Torah calls us. And we're also hard in some ways. That's our stubbornness. At the Cheda Egel, when the Jews worshiped the golden calf, so Hashem said to Moshe, I'm going to go destroy all the Jews. And Hashem said, why? Ki Am Keshe Oref, because they are a stiff-necked people. They're hard people. So Moshe then responded to Hashem, Yochna Hashem Bekirbenu, Hashem should walk amongst us because we are stiff-necked. So it's funny. Hashem says, I'm going to destroy you because you're so stubborn. And then Moshe says, Hashem, please reward us because we're so stubborn. Come walk amongst us. Be with us. So what's Moshe's response to Hashem? So Moshe is saying is that the same reason that we were supposed to be destroyed because of us being stubborn, that's the reason that Hashem should protect us and leave us around. Because there is definitely an advantage to being a stubborn people. And he says, because, you know, we spent now 2,000 years in exile from our land, I'm subject to pressures from the Goyim, and look, we're still here. Why is that? Because we're stubborn. The harder that we are, you know, that we are put to the test, the harder we become. And we cling to our beliefs and our faith, despite all those challenges. He says that we know, next to the crematoriums in the concentration camps, you'd hear the screams of Shema Yisrael. Jews giving their lives for Hashem's sake, they never let up on their faith. You know, they became even stronger in their emunah. So the more you cook an egg, the harder the egg becomes, and the more you cook a Jew, the stronger a Jew becomes as well. So that's an important symbolism. On Pesach, we talk about redemption. We talk about the Jews becoming a people. We also recognize the fact that Pesach is to strengthen our faith in Hashem. And Pesach is that sticks with us, that our faith in Hashem began at Pesach and only becomes stronger as we go through more historically. So that's a symbolism we have of the egg on the Seder plate. An important lesson for us to take at the Seder. The 4 cups of wine. So that we know that there's 4 cups of wine that we drink at the Seder. And the Gemara tells us, the sages explain, it has to do with 4 different terms of redemption in the Chumash. It says, Votsesi, I'll take you out of Mitzrayim. Vitzalti, I'll save you. Vigaalti, I will redeem you. Vilakachti, and I will take you as my nation. So it's 4 different terms of Geula, of redemption, and 4 different cups. Now, these 4 cups are looked at as 4 steps, meaning it's not just 4 synonyms. Each one of those 4 terms, and it's described by many, each of those 4 terms is a different step in Hashem saving us. And this is described by the Chida, Rav Yosef David Azulai, a great, you know, a prolific Jewish writer, and he writes that over the course of the 12 months of the Makos, of the 10 plagues, so we found that the Jews one by one were redeemed level by level. So he says the first step was that we stopped the hard labor. So as soon as the Makos began, the beginning of Makas Dam, the beginning of blood. At that point, the rabbis teach us that the Jews stopped the hard labor. They still had to do small tasks for their masters, but they stopped enslaving them in harsh ways. That was step number one. Step number two was when the labor stopped completely. At a certain point in the Makos, it says on Rosh Hashanah, that year, so the Makos began in Nisan, that year in Rosh Hashanah, they stopped the hard labor. So at that point, they were no longer serving the Egyptians in any way. Step three was on Pesach of that year, when they left Mitzrayim. That's when they actually were released from Mitzrayim, were freed. And then step four was when they received the Torah. That's when they became God's nation, at Har Sinai and Shavuos. So those are 4 different steps. And actually, it very much fits the words of the Torah itself. The Torah says, for step one, V'tzeisi eschem mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim. I will take you out from under the hard burdens of Egypt. So step one was no more hard labor. And then it says, V'tzalti eschem, I will save you mi'avodasam from their work, meaning totally, no more work at all. Step three is v'ga'alti eschem b'zorn tzuyav shvatim gedolim. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgment. That was leaving Mitzrayim. That was the makos. That was the final goal of leaving Mitzrayim. And then the fourth pasuk is v'lakachti eschem l'olam. I'll take you as my nation. That was when they got the Torah. At that point, we became Hashem's nation. So we have 4 cups of wine, each one leading to another step.
Yeah. Alan
had a question about who the source was. It was the Chida. Same as Yosef David Azulai. This is Chaim Yosef David Azulai.
On Shabbos, I usually take the grapefruit juice because I don't have alcohol.
Yeah.
Is it on Pesach, is it particularly important to have wine? Is it okay to have grapefruit juice?
Grape juice is okay. If you can handle a little wine in it, it'd be better. And I don't know if you have an allergy or if you just don't like it, but even if the mixing in a little bit to the wine, if you want to dilute the grape juice, a little bit of wine might be better for you. If you totally don't like it, then it's okay to have grape juice. But I'll explain to you why. I'll actually get to that point. Usually in halacha, grape juice and wine are pretty much equal. In Kiddush, you can have grape juice on Kiddush. You can have grape juice for any occasion where you need to have wine, you can have grape juice. There is a particular emphasis on wine for Pesach, really for two reasons. Number one is because part of the idea of the four cups of wine is supposed to be we're acting with like nobility. And part of the nobility is that, you don't go to a great fancy banquet and pour your cups of grape juice. They're pouring out fancy wine. That's number one. If you don't like the wine, then you wouldn't take the wine. There's an additional point also made by Rosh Shlomo Zalman Arbach. Rosh Shlomo Zalman was to ask the question. He'd say, well, if we're trying to mark four different steps of redemption, why four cups of wine? We could have, four apples. We can have four pieces of chicken. Like, why is it four cups of wine to mark these steps? So he says that the one food that we have that the effects build up portion by portion is alcohol. The first cup of wine, you feel a little bit. Second cup, you feel a little more. Third cup, you feel a little more. For the fourth cup, you're feeling much, much more woozy, right? And the point is because these steps of redemption, they weren't all independent steps. They were acted independently, but they were a buildup. The Jews, they slowly were released. They were slowly let off the work, and then slowly became Hashem's nation. So at Pesach, we symbolize that by having a drink, which actually builds up the effects on us piece by piece. So there's definitely, yeah.
So sometimes you'll go to a Kiddush and people will make shechol and they'll have alcohol or something like that. So what have I never heard of?
On what?
Shechol, on a liquor of some sort.
Right, but only the afternoon. You don't do that on Friday night.
Okay, all right, but still it's acceptable. So what about, for example, Pesach? I've never heard of anyone using a kosher liquor of some sort instead of the four cups.
Well, wine is ideal for sure, halachically.
I suggested, but I haven't never come up. I don't understand.
Technically, if you didn't have wine, you kosher for Pesach liquor, you have to find some. But if technically you could if you didn't have any wine. You could. That's called Charm Medina. If it's the beverage of the... You could. But wine is always considered the most significant drink, halachically. It's more elegant, it's more significant, it's more...
For health reasons, you can't. You are allowed to have grape juice.
Yes, correct. Yeah, so for health reasons, you can't have wine, or you really just can't stand it, or you really have an allergy, you could have grape juice, it's totally fine.
Yeah. Is there something a certain percentage, if you can? I thought there was something with, if you can, at least have a certain percentage.
So I don't know the percentage, but just if you can mix in a little bit, they used to taste a little alcohol, then there'd be an advantage to that. Again, there's no reason to make yourself sick, or if you really can't stand it, you don't have to have it. That's for sure. The grape juice is totally fine in terms of that. If someone who doesn't get sick, just doesn't want to have so much wine, or doesn't like wine, so then there's an advantage to pouring a little bit of wine into your grape juice just to get a little bit of that alcohol flavor for this reason. So that definitely is something to think about.
And the share is 3.3 ounces. So it's not like, when I first became religious, I thought the cup was the share.
Yeah, yeah, no.
I had no idea. 3.3 ounces.
Right,
Each cup, because you can get it, just have 3.3 ounces.
What advice are you getting towards the end? Like a small person likes them. Take them, right?
So then have some grape juice, or just have a little wine in it, just grape juice. Yeah, it's fine. If you buy the Rashi Light, 3% alcohol, wine, then it tastes like grape juice basically anyways. So you can do that also. Usually for my fourth cup, I do have something like that, some very light wine, I don't want to have so much more alcohol, but I still want to have the wine. So that's that. But that's important to note also, that the amount you have to have is very small. It's best to get a small cup, about 3.3 ounces. There's a few different variations of what that shear is. We call it between 3 and 4 ounces. And
total or per cup?
Per cup.
Per cup.
Okay. So, right. But if you have one of these huge goblets and it's like a 14-ounce goblet and you pour in your wine, after the first cup, you're already gone. It's not, that's definitely not recommended.
My mother-in-law says you can have a sip, which I learned you really can't.
Right, it's best to drink the full cup or at least half the cup if the cup has that amount. Right.
So
correct.
You can't use a more decorative big cup because you're not filling it up?
It wouldn't be as good, right. Meaning the ideal is to finish your cup. So if you have a small cup, it's easy to finish.
Right.
If you have a large cup, then finishing it is hard and you get very drunk.
Yes.
So the best would be have a small cup, fill it all the way up and finish the whole thing. If you can't do that, you can finish majority of that cup. If all you have is a large cup, then you don't have to make yourself drunk. You can just drink drink the amount you're supposed to have, a few ounces. But best to get small cups for Pesach and fill them all up and drink them down. That's the best thing to do. Okay. So I want to move on to the beginning of a Maggid in the Haggadah. The Maggid is really the main part of our discussion is Maggid. Maggid is where we actually tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The mitzvah on Pesach night is V'hagadat al Vintcha. You have to tell the story. That's the mitzvah. And that story occurs during the portion of the Haggadah called Maggid. So Maggid is something which is, you know, For years I was always frustrated because Maggid is something which, if you're trying to tell a story, it doesn't quite tell a story so straight. Now, you feel like you're bouncing back and forth between the story and other points, and you're quoting random verses throughout Tanakh, and going back to the story again, and telling something else. So as a storybook, Maggid doesn't seem to do the trick. But we have the wrong perspective on it. Because Maggid's not meant to be a storybook. Maggid's meant to be for us sort of a platform or an outline from which we tell the story. So what the rabbis are giving us in the Haggadah is bullet points. And each bullet point in Maggid is supposed to be for us somewhat of a springboard or a framework through which we should tell the story. So it's important that, you know, we have some preparation before Pesach, or at least some understanding of these bullet points, so that we can expand upon that our Seder. If you just read through Maggid straight, you do walk away confused. It's because it's not a straight, clear story. That's the reality of it. But each point in Maggid is meant to bring out a certain context of the story, a certain highlight of the story, and if you're able to build upon that, then it becomes much, much more meaningful. So we shouldn't be frustrated by the fact that Maggid is not an easy, quick-to-read story. We should understand that Maggid, the rabbis are giving us just the outline, the bullet points, to create a more emotional and a more in-depth discussion of the Seder. So I'm going to begin. Maggid begins with the famous Halach Ma'anya, where we pick up the matzah and we present it as the bread of affliction, which was eaten in Mitzrayim. That's Halach Ma'anya. So the Halach Ma'anya continues and says, Kol dichfin yesei v'yechol. All that are hungry should come and eat. All that are needy should come and v'yifsach and do Pesach with us. So Halach Ma'anya extends an invitation to the poor right there in the middle of our Seder. And it's, you know, many, many Haggadahs ask the question, it's a funny point to be inviting in guests. Mm. I mean, you should invite them in before, seemingly. Or he's going to point out, maybe wait till, if you're inviting people in to eat, then maybe wait till there's actually food on the table, right? Because you're saying, cool, anyone's hungry, come and eat. Yeah, when are you going to eat? About 2.5 hours from now? I mean, you'll have a little celery in between. You already had your celery, so your parsley, right? So what are you inviting him in for? So I don't know if this is the simple meaning of it, but he brings here a very important point in terms of how we regard having guests at our table. The question is, you know, why is Halach Ma'anya inviting in guests when there's nothing to feed them? Let's invite them in when there's more food around. So he says, this, I don't know if this is what the Haggadah exactly means, but this is like an important understanding for us. It says in Pirkei Avos, the way you're supposed to treat the poor is you ani and b'nei b'secha. The poor should be members of your household. Meaning there's two ways of inviting guests. Some people, when a guest's coming, they say, okay, everybody, we got to clean everything up. We got to make the nicest food around. We got to sweep. We got to mop. Bring out the china. And it becomes a whole to-do. For some people, having a guest is, okay, this is my life. This is my house. My house is not the cleanest place in the world. And I eat regular food. But you're welcome to join me and be part of my family. Two different ways to have guests. So when it says that the aniyim, the poor, should be members of your household, the point is that you're letting them become part of your life, your family, and your home, which may not be perfect all the time. It may not be sparkling clean.
Or it could be elevated.
You know, so again, there are times certainly we want to honor the guests. But to say that we have to only have guests over everything's perfect, that's not the attitude of Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is telling us the attitude is that they become part of your family. So if it's good enough for my family, my guests should feel comfortable being part of my family. And sometimes a guest feels bad. They come in and you've stopped your entire life routine to make sure everything's perfect for them. So often the guest feels more comfortable if you say, okay, you know, the house is not perfect today. You know, the bed's made for you and there's some food on the table. But I'm sorry I didn't make you an elaborate lab. That makes the guest more comfortable at times because they feel they're part of the household. So to invite in the guest when all you have on the table is a little bit of matzah, that's much, again, sort of a more natural experience than they only come in when they see like this lavish, you know, banquet on the table. So again, I don't think that's exactly what it means in terms of the Haggadah, but it's a lesson for us to take out of it. The Haggadah, often you can bring out lessons in life, lessons in Emunah, even if it's not the exact meaning of the words in the Haggadah. So he says you're inviting in the guests who are hungry only at the point when you have matzah on the table to show that, you know, your presence is just a natural part of my life. I'm not like stopping everything to treat you. Now, there are times you have a guest, you want to show them special honor, which is fine, and then you will stop your life routine and make sure everything is perfect. But in general, we shouldn't go crazy over having a guest. We should make them naturally part of our homes, make them feel as a natural part of the house, not as a specially treated person. He continues here with another very fascinating account, fascinating story. Halach Ma'anya has a focus on chesed, taking care of the poor. And it's important to note in Pesach, there's a special notion to take care of the poor. I mean, by every yantif, there's an idea of giving tzedakah beforehand and making sure those who are needy are cared for. On Purim, we have Matan Slav Yonim. We have to give tzedakah on Purim. But Pesach also has a special emphasis on taking care of the poor. We find there's a minhag called Kimcha de Pischa, that before Pesach, people go around collecting money so people can afford Pesach food. And we understand that because Pesach is very expensive. we all know that. When you're paying $22 a pound for matzah, it certainly adds up, plus everything else. So there is definitely a special idea to take care of the poor before Pesach. But in general, in the Seder itself, we extend invitations called Dich V'Nyeseh V'Yechol. And we want to be sure that on Pesach, we celebrate being free, we celebrate being nobility, we celebrate being kings and queens. We want to be sure that everybody feels that way. So if I'm sitting there at my table and I'm acting as a king, but there's somebody down the block who's poor and can't afford to have the meal that I'm having or have the new clothes that I'm wearing or sit in the comfortable chairs I'm sitting in, so that Jew is not feeling like a king or a queen. So I have to be sure before Pesach, when we're all celebrating the fact that we're freed from Mitzrayim, we're all kings and queens, I have to be sure that every Jew feels that way. So there's this special notion of giving tzedakah prior to Pesach. Now in the Haggadah itself, as we just read, we extend an invitation. Even if it's just a formality, we say kol dich v'nyeseh v'yechol. We say that everybody who's hungry should come and eat because we want to be sure that we cared for the poor on Pesach. So everybody should feel that they are part of this nobility, the royalty of being kings and queens. So he brings in this Haggadah here, a very powerful stories about chesed. Again, it's not exactly the point in the Haggadah, but it's just a lesson for us to take out of it. Rav Shimshon Pinkus Zatzal was an American who lived in Israel. He was a very powerful speaker. He was unfortunately killed in a car accident as someone of a young man. Those who may have seen some of his books, heard his speeches, a very, very powerful, passionate, emotional person. So it says here, he was once asked by somebody, tell us a real Jewish story. Give us a Jewish story. What's a real Jewish type of story? So he thought about it, and he told the story about the following person. Rav Chaim Salvechuk, or Rav Chaim Brisker, was the Rav in the town of Brisk. And he is known to be a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a great tzaddik. And there's legends about the way that he took care of the poor in his town. Legends meaning they're true, but he's legendary for it. That's what I mean by legends. He's legendary for the way that he took care of the poor. His tzedakah was unbelievable, levels that we can't imagine. So for instance, his home was open at all times to the poor, as if it wasn't even his own. People would come in, people would leave, take the food, sleep in his bed. No, there was no limitations as to what the poor could do in that house. It would happen that sometimes Rav Chaim would want to go to sleep on his own bed and somebody would be sleeping in it. And he'd go home and he would sleep on the floor because there was a needy person or a guest sleeping in his own bed. The story goes that one time there was a guest in the house who came over to him, not realizing that he was the one who owned the house. And he said to him, you know, like, how long is it acceptable for me to stay here? Like, you know, I'm in the house, I've been here for a few days. Like, what's considered acceptable around here? So again, not knowing that Rav Chaim was the... okay, there it goes. Okay, fine. Thank you. My technology consultant. So one time the guy asked him, so what's acceptable in staying in the house? So Rav Chaim said, you know, I've been here for years, no one's thrown me out.
That's great.
But that was his response. That was the kind of person he was. So that wasn't yet the Jewish story. So Rav Pinkus told, this is his real Jewish story. Maisa Yehudi. He says that one time, the people of the city noticed that Rav Chaim, who was the Rav of the city, his house was freezing. You know, it was a cold winter. We're talking about in, I guess, Lithuania. And you know, his house wasn't heated. So you think about how cold it would be, and it was really, the house was really freezing. So the people of the town said, we have to make sure the rabbi has some wood so he can fuel his fireplace and warm up the house. So they went and they got together a bunch of wood and they filled up his storehouse with wood. And this wood should have lasted them for a long time. But after a few days, the people of the town came back to the house, and it was freezing, and nothing changed. And they said to the rabbi, they said, what happened? And they said to the Rebbetzin, what happened? So the Rebbetzin said, why didn't you use the wood that we sent you? And she said, what happened? She said that as soon as my husband found out that the storehouse was filled up with wood, he invited all of the poor of the town to come help themselves. And therefore, after a few hours, it was all gone. Not a single log was left for us.
Wow.
So the people of the town said, okay, there's a problem. The rabbi's freezing. Like, what do we do for him? So they said, we have an idea. We're going to once again fill up the storehouse with wood. And they closed it up. And they said to the rabbi and his family that we give you no permission to give us to anybody else besides for yourselves. So now he couldn't give it away because we're only giving it to you on the condition you use it. You can't give it away. So next day they came to his house and they said to him, it was still freezing. and they said to him, Rabbi, what's going on over here? So the Rebbetzin said, well, yesterday you brought us wood and you said we can't give it out. But my husband said, well, how could I have a warm house when the poor are freezing? So he didn't touch it. He wouldn't use the wood.
I thought he lent it out.
No, he couldn't give it out. He lent it out. So he couldn't give it out because he wasn't allowed to. They said he can't give it out. But he's like, I can't use the wood if others are freezing in town. So that was the story. So that was called a true Jewish story. Sensitivity to others.
He's violating the 11th commandment, though.
Which is what?
Don't be a fool.
Don't be a fool. Okay. But when your sensitivity and compassion is to that point. He wasn't putting on a show. He's saying, I can't reasonably warm my home and feel good about it if others are freezing. That was his emotion.
Have to explain it to him. All right.
That was his emotion.
Whenever I hear these stories, I always think about the poor Rebbetzins, right? I mean, the rabbi goes and he gives his last thing away. He gives the wife's candlesticks away.
Right.
So I always think about the poor Rebbetzins in these stories.
Okay, so
she's freezing, right?
I would think and I would suggest that he wouldn't have done it had the Rebbetzin not wanted to do it. Right. Because your first obligation is towards your spouse. So if his spouse is freezing and she can't tolerate it, I can't imagine Rav Chaim would have given away the wood.
But that's my take on the story.
Yeah,
you know,
right. Right.
And these stories, some of these stories are apocryphal.
Right. I mean, probably. It could be, but each one you have to trace its sources. But on the other hand, if there's a whole slew of stories like this about one person, you know, at least some of them are going to be true.
Right.
You know?
That's true.
There's a famous story of the Chafetz Chaim. Maybe you've heard the other story.
There's a lot of stories about the Chafetz Chaim.
One time he was brought in to testify in court. And they were, I can't remember all the details, but they were saying, they're asking, I think, the lawyers, like, why should we trust this rabbi? And they said, well, there's a story about him that one time somebody came in his house and stole something. And Chafetz Chaim started running after him, screaming out, I forgive you, as he ran away. So I think the judge said to him, well, how do I know that's true? Why should I trust that story? He said, I don't know if it's true either, but they don't say the stories like that about you and me. So that's the bottom line. Like, if these stories are all exactly accurate, we don't know, but definitely Rav Chaim fit the bill for these stories. That's the point. So the chesed is really a foundation of what it means to be a Jew. And if you want to know a true Jewish story, this is a story of compassion, of caring, of chesed. And first thing, again, the person whose level of chesed was kind of beyond us, and we can't imagine having our homes that open. But there are people even to this very day who have homes like that. It's not common, but it exists, you know. Yes, everyone's read the biography of Mrs. Machlis, Rebbe Hani Machlis, who was passed a few years ago. It's incredible stories of this store, and she was living a few years ago. An American living in Eretz Yisrael, whose home was as open as we're saying about Rav Chaim, you know. Rebbe Kanievsky, Aliyah Shalom also would have people sleeping in her home, in her bed all the time. And so you have people even to this very day that have such a level of chesed in open homes. So even if it's beyond us, we have to be inspired that there is, you know, such people out there. The Halach Ma'ane continues. It says, you know, now we are here, next year in Eretz Yisrael. Now we are slaves, next year we should be free. So the Haggadah is telling us that there's some concept of what's going to be, you know, of contrasting what's now and what's going to be. Now the question many people have is that, you know, people are sitting there in Eretz Yisrael saying that line, right? This year we're here, next year in Eretz Yisrael. And you'll say, well, if I'm sitting in Eretz Yisrael, I mean, nowadays we have the privilege that we can go and travel there, and we can be there and enjoy our time there and be safe. So what exactly is that line supposed to mean? And you know, we can all go there and we can all enjoy being in Eretz Yisrael. So obviously, one point I'm making is that even though we have access to Eretz Yisrael, we don't have the full Geula. We know we're still waiting for Hashem to give us the final redemption, and that's clear. But there's another point which is to be made over here. Now, when the Jews were in Mitzrayim, they had to wait an entire year to be freed. From the time that Hashem started the Makos until they left was a year, as we mentioned. Hashem has the ability to take them right out, just to pull them out right away. Why did they have to sit there for a year, still suffering to some degree, and why weren't they redeemed immediately? So let me answer this question. I mean, I think the most basic answer is that Hashem wanted them to have to witness the Makos and learn from them. Part of the advantage of being in Mitzrayim for that year was that Hashem made a display for them. Hashem presented himself and his power to the Egyptians and to the Jews. And by sitting there for a year in Mitzrayim, they learned so much about Hashem and how much Hashem cares for them and how much Hashem runs the world. That's one answer, and I think that's the most basic answer. He says here another point. He says that Hashem's always trying to test us. How much do we really yearn for redemption? Meaning that let's say somebody who is sitting there in Russia when there are pogroms happening constantly. So it was a big deal for them to say, yeah, I wish Mashiach would come. Somebody was sitting there in Poland, in 1940, when Hitler was throwing people into the camps. So for them to say, I hope Mashiach will come, is a very easy thing to say. For someone sitting there in the peace of 2019 in America, for us to say, I wish Mashiach would come, is not as easy to say. Hopefully we all yearn for it. But when your existence is somewhat comfortable, when life is somewhat peaceful, so do you actually yearn for redemption or not? If Hashem came to the Jews in Mitzrayim, when they were still doing forced hard labor, and he says, I'm going to free you, so every single Jew would say, okay, I'm here, I'm in. Count me in, and they'd run for redemption. After a year, when they've been let off hard work, they're living peacefully in their homes, they're not freed yet, but they're not working anymore, and they're in Mitzrayim, and things are somewhat okay, do they still yearn for redemption at that point? And we know the rabbis teach us that 4/5 of the Jews didn't make it out alive. The 4/5 of the Jews did not want to be redeemed, and they said that we'd rather stay in Mitzrayim, and they were killed. They weren't able to leave. So Hashem was trying to put to the test those Jews. Hashem wanted to see which Jews truly yearn for redemption, which Jews truly want to be freed, and which Jews are just screaming because of the pain, but when it came down to it, they weren't so interested in redemption. And that was the question. So we have to ask ourselves the same questions nowadays. Nowadays, Hashem has given us a period, thank God, a very peaceful period, relatively, of history. Since the end of World War II, overall, things have been relatively quiet for the Jews. Again, it's always relative, but it's quiet for the Jews. So during World War II, or probably the century beforehand, it wasn't hard for Jews to say, I wish Mashiach would come. But 80 years later, when things are peaceful, do we still have that yearning or not? And that's the question. So at the Seder is a time where not only do we speak about the early redemption from Mitzrayim, the first redemption, we also speak about the future redemption. And it's supposed to develop within us the desire that we, just like Hashem redeemed us initially, we also still be redeemed from our galus. We should have that desire. So at the Seder, we speak about this concept. We say, now we're here, but next year we should be in Eretz Yisrael. No, we yearn for the final redemption. We still are slaves to some degree as we are in exile, and we're not under the Mashiach's rule, but next year we yearn to be under the Mashiach's rule. So the question always is left for us: do we also yearn for redemption? Are we interested? Are we not interested? So Hashem will give sort of like the calm before the storm, give that time of peace, to test out Jews to see how much do they yearn to be redeemed or not. Are they hoping for Mashiach, or are they content with what they have? And the answer is we're content, then we're missing the point. If the answer is that we realize that life isn't as it should be, that we don't have full redemption, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a Jewish king, we are not serving Hashem to the best of our ability, we don't have unity amongst the Jews, with many Jews who are not affiliated with Judaism, and life is not as it should be, then that's where our yearning should go. It should go towards Mashiach. And that's the question we have to ask ourselves. So in the Haggadah itself, we're trying to bring out that point. Even though we're sitting here now in a relative time of calm, we still yearn for Mashiach to come and bring us the final redemption. We'll do one more. One more point over here. So as you move through the Haggadah, the next paragraph, okay, next week I'll try to bring Haggadah so we can look at it inside. The next paragraph, Yitaman Ishtana, which I'm going to skip over for now. And after Man Ishtana, we give an answer. Yitaman Ishtana is the question, why is tonight different than all other nights? And we answer that Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves in Egypt, and Hashem freed us with an outstretched arm, mighty hand, outstretched arm. And then it says, if Hashem didn't take us out of Mitzrayim, then we and our children and our children's children would still be meshubadim, would still be subjects to Par Mitzrayim. So the famous question is, well, is that really true? I mean, we're talking about slavery of about 4,000 years ago, whatever, 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, something like that. So historically, slaves have gotten freed. Happened in America and happened in every society. I mean, any nation enslaved eventually did become free. So so the question always is, what do we mean that we still would be subjects to Paro Mitzrayim when seemingly that's not true historically? So one answer is, well, who says? That's one answer. Maybe it would be true that that's something that we don't know. But the other answer is there's a distinction made in the terminologies used. You can be an Eved or you can be Meshubad. Eved means I'm a slave. Meshubad means that I am subject to another's rule. Two different things. Meaning an Eved means that I'm actively working for somebody else. Meshubad means that I personally am subject to that person. Now let me explain the difference. This is actually quoting from the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi makes this distinction. Now, when we left from Mitzrayim, we remained avadim. We're still slaves, but we're servants, not the power to Hashem. A Jew is always a servant. And we serve Hashem, and we're actively pursuing serving Hashem. The question is, where is our allegiance? To who am I loyal to? Who influences me the most? That's really the question. So if we're in Mitzrayim, not only did we serve Paro, but he was the one to whom we were loyal. Our allegiance, we were subjects of Paro. And Paro's influence was upon us in a very powerful way. And if Hashem didn't save us, that influence would still be here. So even if we weren't serving Paro anymore, the influence of Paro, that those feelings of being subjects to Paro, or again, Paro's likes, people like Paro throughout history, they would still be mishabet us. They would still be ones, we were still subjects to them. Once Hashem freed us, so even if there might be times where we're forced to serve others, I mean, he quotes over here, somebody who was doing forced labor in a concentration camp for Hitler. So he's not meshubed to somebody else. The answer is, well, he might be doing labor for somebody else, but ultimately his allegiance is towards Hashem. And that's who deep down, he's only a subject to Hashem. He might be forced to work with somebody else because they forced him with a gun and they forced him with a sword. But that doesn't show where his actual loyalty and allegiance lies. So the difference between Meshubadim Hayinu versus Avadim Hayinu, Avadim is where we're physically serving. Meshubadim is where does that loyalty go? Where is that allegiance? So the fact that Hashem took us to Mitzrayim, that made us Hashem subjects for eternity. And a Jew is always a subject of Hashem. The question always is, we talk about what's true freedom? And the Jewish thought of true freedom is not, do I have to work or not? It's, in my own mind, in my own emotions, am I free? Where are my thoughts? Where's my loyalty? I understand, maybe I'm working for somebody, but he doesn't own me. He might force me, but he doesn't own me. Only Hashem has control over me. And that's true freedom. I'm somebody who, in terms of my own personal self, I'm in control. And I know where my loyalty lies. So I may have to work for somebody else, but that's not called being meshubah. That's not called being subjects of them. I'm subjects of Hashem, but I work for somebody else. And that's how we have to view it. You have sometimes somebody who might be imprisoned. So physically his body is locked up, but in his mind, he's free. In his mind, he's thinking. He's developing thoughts, he's learning Torah, he's connecting, he's planning. And his mind, even though the body might be physically having to be behind bars, the mind can be free.
Sharansky did that.
Yep. Sharansky, yeah. Right. That's a good example. Very good example. So was he in prison or was he free? Well, the body was in prison, but the mind was free. Happens to be, you look at, you know, probably thousands of people in the Soviet Union were like that. You know, their bodies were stuck there in prison in the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain.
Menloin?
Who's
the person?
No, it's not. Yeah, right. Yeah, another Soviet prisoner. Yeah, another refusenik, I think. Right, yeah.
You know something, I really think we have to think about this Pesach, the Seder night. It's going to be the Warsaw Ghetto uprising soon. And these people were making the Seder, and the Germans came in with tanks. The first Seder.
Right, well.
Warsaw Ghetto, 1942.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
With my daughter, we always talk about that. And they were actually trying to make a Seder. They didn't care, they were all going to die.
Right.
And the tanks were rolling in, you know.
So that's, you know, that's freedom. You know, that's despite the fact they're in prison, that is freedom. And there's so many stories like that of people that they did as they pleased, despite that they may have been subject to others. So the answer is that if Hashem takes out Mitzrayim, then we would be loyal to Paro or Paro's likes, people like Paro forever. But now that Hashem took us out, even though we may have to serve others at times, ultimately, we are free. And this is what it says in Pirkei Avos. Nobody is free unless they are involved in learning Torah. You know, the fact that when you show your loyalty to Hashem, and your mind is free, and your spirit is free, even if your body is enslaved, you're still a free person. Okay, to be continued.